Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
You can spend all the money you want, millions and millions and millions and millions, telling people how great you are. And then something happens in politics. A flashpoint. 4 years ago, it was Hillary Clinton calling everyone deplorables who didn't agree with her. And the tittering and the mocking voices of laughter that came out and resonated with many 63 million Americans. And now we have that piece of mocking and laughing where Don Lemon, the mannequin of CNN, mocking and laughing people, mocking them as rubes and hicks and fools and illiterates, and the tittering laughter that went on with the New York Times reporter and the writer and then a Republican never-Trumper. People don't forget that. It's really stupid, but it reveals something about the media. Go against them. Go against their point of view, and they will destroy you. They will mock you. They will strip the skin from your bones.
Ask anyone who knows me. They'll tell you. I don't believe in belittling people. One of my guests said something that made me laugh. And while in the moment, I found that joke humorous.
Well, Donald Trump couldn't find Ukraine on a map if you had the letter U and a picture of an actual physical crane next to it. He knows that this is, you know, an administration defined by ignorance of the world. And so that's partly him playing to their base and playing to their audience, the credulous boomer rube demo that backs Donald Trump, that wants to think that... That Donald Trump's a smart one, and there y'all elitists are dumb.
You elitists with your geography and your maps and your spelling, even though my
math and your reading.
Yeah, your reading, you know, your geography, knowing other countries, sipping your latte.
All those lines on the map.
Only them elitists know where Ukraine is.
And that brings me to our subject today. There was a man who dared go against the popular conventions of the left and the media and the Democratic Party. He had been a black revolutionary. He saw what social justice warriors, the white woke people, had done to the black community. The poverty, the forced ignorance, the substandard schools. And he decided to stand up against it. His journey led him from the left to the right because of the words in the Declaration of Independence, the words that involve natural law, that all men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with unalienable rights. An intellectual, a man who shouldn't have succeeded but did, who stood up against the most withering personal attacks. A hero. Clarence Thomas, in his own words, the movie's out. We'll be talking to director Michael Peck. We're also going to be talking to Jason Meisner, the Chicago Tribune, about that baloney factory that Martin Sandoval, former state senator, now cooperating with the feds and the big federal investigation and the RICO driving the bus. And Pritzker, who forgot to mention baloney in his big corruption speech. Jeff Carlin is here, executive producer of the Rokon Show on WGN. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and a member of that great newspaper's editorial board. And where are you? Thinking about heroes? Black History Month? You thinking about heroes that score points, touchdowns, get write-ups by sports writers. You think about a hero standing alone, being beaten down with the worst kinds of racist tropes, and refusing to bend his knee. That might be a hero. And you're on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
Well, it's stereotypes draped in sanctimony and self-congratulation. There's different sets of rules for different people. If you criticize a black person who's more liberal, you're a racist. Whereas if you can do whatever to me or to now Ben Carson, and that's fine because you're not really black because you're not doing what we expect black people to do. It's a tactic, and when people see it being successful, they don't realize they're going to be the next ones in the Tower of London.
There's a movie that I told you about at the beginning of this that's out. A movie about a hero. What's a hero? Is it somebody who scores touchdowns, shoots baskets, hits home runs, with flesh peddlers in the media promoting them? Or is it somebody who thinks for himself and stands up against great odds? The heroic stance of Clarence Thomas, Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, is something that every American should see, especially this month, Black History Month, and we have the director, Michael Peck. Mr. Peck, good morning.
Good morning.
Why did you make this movie?
Well, we had heard through mutual friends that Justice Thomas was getting tired of being defined by his enemies, of the sort of half-truths and outright falsehoods circulating about him. So I met with him, and then I researched his life. At the time, I didn't know much more about him than I learned from watching his contentious confirmation hearings in 1991. But after doing the research, I discovered, as you implied in your intro, that he is a great American hero and has a great story, a classic American story, coming from really dire poverty in the segregated South to the highest court of the land. And it was a story that I wanted to tell. Subsequent events, like the Kavanaugh nomination process, which had the same playbook, have only made the film more relevant.
For those of you listening, you know that I'm a conservative. Clarence Thomas is a conservative. He came to his conservatism on a tortured road that Mr. Peck explains and lays out, and Clarence Thomas, in his own words, lays out in the movie that's out now. He was born in extreme poverty. There was an outhouse where he lived in the rural South in Georgia that emptied out into the backyards of his home and his neighbors. They lived in a shack in the swampy lands. And then he was saved when his mother gave him up to be raised by his grandfather, who I find the grandfather to be an archetype, American archetype.
Yeah. Well, that's right. When Clarence Thomas was about 8, his mother, who couldn't realize she couldn't raise her 2 boys in that dire poverty you just described very well, John, took him to her father, his grandfather, to raise. And his grandfather was a very powerful influence on Justice Thomas's life. And he is an archetype. Justice Thomas likes to say there are others like him, not as great as his grandfather, but that kind of African-American has sort of been erased from history. He was self-reliant. He had hardly any education, less than 6 months of education, but he believed in education. He believed in biblical principles. He believed in hard work, tough love, and he turned Justice Thomas's life around. You know, as soon as he came, he started with his saying, "Old man Kant is dead, I helped bury him," and many other such work from son to son. And it changed completely his life. And he'd converted to Catholicism, very unusual for an African-American in those days, and sent Justice Thomas to parochial schools, then segregated, run by these Irish nuns that continued that kind of tough love. But although he felt total love from the nuns, and they did not care that their young charges were African-American. And that turned Justice Thomas's life around for a while. That's right. And I think you make a good point, John. It's not me who's telling the story in the film. It's called Justice Thomas in His Own Words because it's based on a very long interview I had with Justice Thomas, 30 hours over 6 months. And he and his wife are the only interviews. And he looks right at camera and tells you what it's like to live through these things. John, you did a very good job eloquently summarizing his life in poverty, but it's very different to hear it directly from Justice Thomas, what it's like to live through it, and he's a great storyteller.
The story that he tells about himself, failing his grandfather. His grandfather told him at the beginning, the door opens both ways. It opens in to welcome you in, but if you break the rules, if you violate the grandfather's understanding of right and wrong, the door will swing open. And when Thomas quits the seminary after begging to be sent there at great expense, think of a truck driver and a black man in the South in those days, what they were making. And the grandfather boots him out of the house. And then Thomas begins his journey. It's almost like, I have to say, reading it, reminded me of college where we learned about the voyage of the hero, Joseph Campbell's Hero of a Thousand Faces. He is buried in his shame, and he is reborn as a black leftist revolutionary, and which something I think most Americans did not know. And he was full of anger and then comes back to the church at a time when he really needed it. It's just so stunning to me to see the formation of this personality that is threatening to the established liberal order. And they destroyed him. They destroyed him. I just could not. To see those magazine covers of just, I'm getting ahead of myself. Please tell the story.
I think you're doing a great job. I think you're quite right. It is like a hero's journey. And he goes through this period of radicalism when he's at Holy Cross. And he finally hits bottom when he gets involved in a anti-war demonstration in Cambridge that becomes violent, gets caught up in the mob mentality of it, and is finally scared by what he's becoming. When he goes back to Holy Cross after midnight, he hadn't prayed in a long time, as you said, he lost his faith. He prays and says to God, "If you'll take anger out of my heart, I'll never hate again." And that's his journey. He starts his spiritual journey back, and his intellectual odyssey, I think you correctly compare it to that, coming back from those radical views to conservatism, a great story. And then he finally gets to the point where he can vote for Ronald Reagan in 1980 and goes to work for the Reagan administration. And once he becomes a public figure, then he's attacked. And the story is then about him dealing with attacks from the left. And you're right, they attempted to destroy him right from the beginning, often using racist tropes that, as Justice Thomas said, you could not use about a liberal African-American without being accused rightly of being a racist. So, yeah, it's a terrible story, but he survives it and surmounts it.
Michael, I want to ask you, too, about the relationship between you and Clarence and how that kind of evolved over that 6 months of doing these very candid, very personal interviews. What was your relationship with him beforehand, and then how does it, I imagine him opening up to you, obviously, over this long, intimate session, but he sounds like, you know, there's a mystery about him. So how'd you crack that mystery, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
Well, Justice Thomas says, he committed himself to this process, and he's very, as the film illustrates, once he's committed to something, he's not going to not go through with it. But it was way harder than he thought. He really had to, I had to make him relive very painful things, but he was really committed to seeing it through. I talked to him a lot beforehand, or not a lot, but some beforehand to get him ready. And then there was the interview process, and my wife, who's my business partner, was there with me, and I'm forced to put him through these painful things. And at the end, I promised the court and his wife to get him out at noon every day, no matter what. And, you know, producers tend to be deceptive about things like that. But I turned the clock, the camera off at noon every day to let him go back to the court. But we always invited him to lunch, and he always stayed for another hour. And after that, in that hour, even though I would pull him through something difficult, he was really back to his joyful, laughing self. And he particularly spent time with the lowest people on the crew totem pole, my son, who was a production assistant, and another production assistant who happened to be Hispanic, who he's now convinced to go to law school. He would talk to them and ask them about their lives after having gone through this, their lives and what they wanted to do. And he took an active interest in them. And he it was an amazing thing. But it was, in fact, even harder for Jenny, his wife, to relive these things. She has apologized to my wife and us, for having it been difficult, but no apology is actually necessary. We are honored that they were willing to live through this. It wasn't easy to put them through it. But I hope they both think it is worth it. I think it will serve the purpose, as John said at the top, of changing Americans' perception of him and dispelling these myths.
The Hollywood Reporter, which is, amazing in this, they call this an undeniably important historical document, which is amazing. I mean, John and I on this podcast all the time talk about how Hollywood and media almost always just falls to the left and wacks and wanes over that and they don't see that. How is that? Is that surprising to you, or have you seen that liberal media seems to be embracing this?
Well, I see some do and some don't. I live in the D.C. area, and one Washington Post critic was very critical, but Ann Hornaday wrote a piece today saying that even though she doesn't agree with Justice Thomas, she found it moving. So I think it's different. I think the average liberal, the actual open-minded liberal, will be more like Ann. And they may not agree with him at the end, but they will come with renewed respect, and they will not believe these myths. I believe everyone should go. I went to see RBG about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, with whom I don't agree. I learned something. I think liberals should go. In order to go, they've got to go to our website to find out where it is, justicethomasmovie.com. It is opening today in many, many cities around the country, including in Chicago. It's at the AMC River East 21. I don't know if that's convenient or how close that is to downtown Chicago, but
we can see it from our perch right now, actually.
I hope, so you particularly have no excuse for not going and seeing it again, and neither do your listeners. And even if they're in the suburbs, they should come in and go. I mean, we need to support these films. The supporters of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, went out in droves. I hope both the supporters of Thomas and his critics come out in droves, to watch the movie. The first weekend, this weekend, is very important, but it'll be there all week. And if people come beyond this week, and they can see the trailer on our website. So it is a moving experience, as John said at the outset. It's not just kind of conservative preaching, if you will. It's a moving story. I think you guys are right to compare it to the Joseph Campbell journey of a hero. It's an archetypical story, another good word that John used, moving to everybody, whatever their politics.
I personally identify with it because he talked about the summers when he and his brother were brought out to the farm, and they had to plow with mules. And the grandfather had a right and a wrong way to do things. You plowed this way, his way. You watered the livestock this way. He was very clear on the things he wanted done, and he did not accept people doing them the easy way. And I identified because my dad was like that. And my dad plowed with a mule. I've joked about it many times in the column and on this podcast. The mule was named Truman. It was brought to the family as part of the Marshall Plan. They named it Truman to sort of mock the fact that they were in dire straits and that they needed help. But, you know, they were trying to salvage some pride. But they were subsistence farmers. And their son is a columnist for the Chicago Tribune.
Mm.
And to get to back to your film, Thomas becomes conservative slowly over time because of his anger toward racism. He goes to the conference in the film, to a conference at the Fairmont Hotel in San Francisco, and sits at a table where he is interviewed by Juan Williams, of all people, who begins the I think the piece that Williams writes tries to be intellectually honest, but can't resist jabbing Thomas for, here's a black man who doesn't like social programs. Here's a black man who thinks social programs are antithetical to freedom. Here's a That's black right. man who dares think that all these white people trying to help us with their trillions of dollars really don't have our best interests at heart. And he that's where it begins, where he gets stabbed in the front and in the sides. How did he deal with that?
I think it was hard. That's right. That Juan Williams piece, you characterized it really brilliantly. I mean, actually, Juan Williams was trying to be sympathetic, unlike many of the people who came subsequently. I think it was hard throughout the 80s when he was working for Reagan, but I think it was sort of unbearably hard to imagine during the Anita Hill confirmation battle, where people were really saying things that were really hurtful about him. By that point, his new wife, they were then newly married, had to rely on their faith to get them through. It was very hard. I think Justice Thomas tries to not let it pull him down, but when he relives it in the film, you could see the hurt today, and you could see the hurt in his wife, who, you know, tears up in this part of the interview. You know, I have been attacked a little bit in the media. I don't really like it too much, like a bad review. But this kind of attack, it's hard to imagine.
It was anyone who thinks that woke world gets angry now has no idea what it was like, must have been like for this man to stand up and have a story told about him that was basically stereotypical in its depiction of the hypersexualized black man who's hitting on everything around him. And he's looking at them saying, it's not true. It didn't happen. And then realizes that when they asked, I think Biden or someone asks him, one of the white liberal Democrats who can't stand a black man thinking for himself, they ask him, would he withdraw? Someone asks him. And he says, I would rather die.
That's right.
That part.
That's right. Because it wasn't really about the confirmation anymore. Now he felt that his honor was at stake. And not only his, he really felt that what was being besmirched were the legacy of his grandfather and the nuns and their values. And he just wanted to stand up for it against the advice of his handlers. At that point, people would say, well, it's the U.S. Senate. You can't attack senators and then expect them to vote for you. So they told him not to give the high-tech lynching speech, not to go out there like that. But he wasn't concerned with the sort of value-maximizing, you know, spin doctor aspect of it. He felt the need to defend himself. And as he said, when the final vote came in confirming him, his attitude then was whoop-de-damn-doo. It was already a horrible, besmirching process, you know, soiling. That's right. It's a really, and then it continued to today. I mean, the covers that you, some of the cartoons you mentioned were all subsequent to the hearing.
They were.
They
made him look, and there was one cartoon showing him as a shoeshine man, shining Scalia's shoes. Another cartoon showed him as a lawn jockey. And then there were other hideous cartoons attached to a piece by Jill Abramson, who became the executive editor of the New York Times. In your mind, why is it that the white liberal press is so threatened by black conservatives?
It's hard to really know, but I mean, they're supposed to be the staunch Democratic supporters. It's just as Thomas would say, he wanted to leave the reservation, something you cannot do. He was the wrong black man. It is so much worse. I myself was on the left when I was growing up, and I became conservative. No one has ever accused me of being a traitor to my race. You know, you don't have the same kind of relentless attacks when you're an African American. In some ways, you know, it's a very interesting cultural phenomenon at one level to think about it, to experience it as something else, but. It's hard to fathom.
I've only been a reporter for 6,000 years. I've learned two things about race and politics, that there's nothing as malleable as a liberal white reporter worried about being called a racist. They will do anything and crawl on their knees and abandon all principle and thought in order to not be called a racist. But there's something else. There's nothing more threatening to the established order and the liberal orthodoxy run by the white woke warriors than a black man standing up for himself, thinking for himself. That's terrifying. You know, they Kunta Kinte in the movie, they hamstrung him. What did they do to Clarence Thomas? They hamstrung him too. We've been talking to Michael Pack, the director of the most important film of the recent times. And every parent, every teacher, I'm married to a teacher, and I'm the father of a teacher. Every teacher should bring their students to see this movie. I'll be interested to see how many Chicago students from the inner city go. And if they don't, that will tell me what I need to know, what I already do know about the state. As long as African-Americans stay on the reservation, they will be fed. And if they stand up like free men and free women and reject that paternalism that Thomas hates so much, they are a threat. Justice Thomas, in his own words, I can't thank you enough, Mr. Peck, for this movie. Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you, and I hope your listeners, you know, go to the AMC River East 21. Thank you.
Or to the website again, which is?
JusticeThomasMovie.com. You can see the trailer there and find out where it's playing.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We're the sauce on your steak. We're the cheese in your cake. We put the spring in Springfield.
We're the lace on the nightgown.
The point after touchdown.
Yes, we put the spring in Springfield.
In the ongoing federal investigation of political corruption in Illinois, rolling from Chicago to Springfield with that bus that's driven by the guy named Rico and people jumping on, people invited to jump on and jump off, there are three great lines. One is Alderman Danny Solis wanting his Viagra and the Asian women. at the massage parlors. The other is Ed Burke saying, did we land the tuna? But the one that struck me, hit me right in the heart and into that little boy I used to be, slicing lunch meat for my dad on the south side at our store, was State Senator Martin Sandoval, a Democrat of Mike Vondra, talking about, what did he say, Jason Meisner?
The he said, don't you have some kind of baloney company, something innocuous to donate, use as kind of a way to donate campaign contributions that wouldn't raise eyebrows. Because, you know, when campaign contributions come from a red light camera company, that can draw some attention.
Something innocuous like a baloney company. I was just stunned by that. You know, he's from the South Side, where his base now, Gage Park, is where my dad had the store, my dad and my Uncle George. The neighborhood has changed somewhat. But what does it mean that Martin Sandoval, $250,000 that he copped to, taken in bribes, $80,000 of which at least came from the red light camera company Safe Speed LLC, run by Nikki Zoller, a Politico, and she's married to Bill Von Haney Jr., the executive vice president of Exelon, which I think they had something to do with lobbying in Springfield. What does this all mean, Jason Meisner?
Well, this is the first big, actually it's the first at all, charges to come out of this investigation. We've been waiting for a while. It's been 4 months since the raids on Sandoval's office and the suburbs, all the mayors out there in the southwest suburbs, southwest side. So this came down as a criminal information on Monday, and then by Tuesday, Marty Sandoval was a convicted felon, and we knew for a fact what a lot of people had been whispering about is that he's cooperating with the Fed, which, of course, is not good news for any of the other people who know they're being looked at by the FBI because of these search warrants that have been out there. So it was big news to come out of this investigation after 4 months of things kind of simmering in the background.
And let me check my scorecard there, Jason. Is that four politicals in Illinois on the wire or wearing a wire? Is that my math right there, if I'm following correctly? Or at least three and an alleged?
I think four. Yeah, let's see. Let me check my scorecard. We got, of course, Danny Solis. We've got Omar Mani, the Tribune. We reported on the day that Sandoval pled guilty to this, that the person who was recording him was Omar Mani, the Safe Speed, one of Safe Speed's founders, and also real estate owner out there. And he was running around recording people for at least a year, probably more, I think more like a year and a half. So, and, you know, there are others, but this whole thing is obviously still mushrooming in different directions. We've got the ComEd investigation involving Mike Madigan, confidant, and all his people, and that's a whole separate avenue. You've got the Burke silo, I guess you would call it, and everything that we just learned yesterday, that Burke may go to trial a year from now. And now you've got the Sandoval angle. So just things going in multiple directions.
If you've been reading anything about this stuff, you've been reading the Chicago Tribune, because Jason Meisner, Ray Long, and other colleagues have been on top of this from the beginning. And what I really like about the pieces that you write, Jason, you're not speculative. You don't have emotion or political agenda, but you do drop a little hint here and there, like right after the criminal information came out on Sandoval, there was a hint of in the copy that he may be cooperating. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh man, this is the one. If you're like one of these inside weasels, you know, these politicians and lobbyists, And just to read that in the Tribune is enough to like crossing an icy river in February without waders. There's just things that shrivel up, you know? And I remember reading that line and laughing because I know how it's edited. I know the scrupulous nature of the editors and you guys in writing it, but just dropping it was just so fine. My hat tip.
Yeah, I think thanks. Appreciate it. The last time we talked, I think a few weeks ago, maybe earlier this month, I think we were talking about safety. Seemed like they were close to wrapping that one up, and sure enough, we weren't quite sure how it was going to come down, but it came down in the form of Marty Sandoval pleading guilty and cooperating. So the other avenues of that investigation have yet to be resolved. We've got, like you said earlier, Mike Vondra, the construction magnate, the asphalt king of Illinois, under investigation for his connections to Sandoval.
You and I did some worked on columns together about Vondra back in the day.
We did. Jason. 10 years ago, I remember. So when his name came up in this investigation, it's like one of those things where if you stick around long enough, everything comes back because we've got John Harris, Blagojevich's former chief of staff, convicted, and somehow get connected. He worked for Vondra. He's part of the investigation now. Mike Vondra, 10 years ago, I think I remember researching for your column about Vondra's effort to be able to dump construction material into his quarries, which instead of a landfill, which has a liner and is more eco-friendly, just dump it right into the quarry. Big lobbying effort in Springfield that was ultimately successful. So he's been around a long time. And then there's a whole other avenue of the Sandoval investigation involving these suburban mayors.
I think there's 20-something. There's a great number of them. All these suburban mayors, their involvement with red lights and with asphalt, because who doesn't put asphalt down, you know? I mean, it's asphalt. It's a thing. I remember watching a whole HBO series that involved guys who poured asphalt. You know, it's just like, hey, you got to have the asphalt.
I like this. The story that, it's not in the paper today, but it'll be in the paper this weekend from my colleagues Joe Maher and Dan Petrella about Vondra's pivot to this recycled asphalt shingle and his push in Springfield using Sandoval's help to approve this stuff, fast track it. He started stockpiling hundreds, thousands of tons of recycled shingles that he collects from construction sites all over the state. They boil it up, they mix it, and they put it into the asphalt, and it's a moneymaker. So it's also, they claim it's environmentally friendly. But of course, behind it all is Marty Sandoval in Springfield pushing Vondra's agenda and taking hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign donations from him.
And the part that kills me as a taxpayer and a driver of the roads is that this technology supposedly is terrible, and everyone says, "Oh, it's prone to cracking. It doesn't last. It's a sham. Anybody selling it to you is selling it just to essentially keep a contract to fix it." So that really kind of drives me nuts. I know that's not in your, I don't know if that's in your reporting exactly, but I know it's a rumor out there that I wholeheartedly believe.
Yeah, the IDOT was putting the brakes on it, saying maybe we should study this a little bit more, not use so much of it, because there were things out there, there were allegations, there were studies done that showed it was prone to cracking. So they were actually saying, we shouldn't use as much. And Marty Sandoval, if you read the story, he flew off the handle. He wrote a letter on his letterhead threatening the then director of IDOT with an ethics investigation and you're not doing your duty. And he was going to haul her in front of his committee, transportation committee, all in this letter from 2014. So he was going to bat for Vondra in a big way. And then you mentioned how corruption can kind of affect everyday people in Illinois. The red light camera thing is just, imagine all those $100 tickets. You know, you take a right on a red out there in Oak Brook Terrace, suddenly you owe $100. And then you find out that the only reason the camera is there in the first place is because bribes are being paid. I mean, that is stuff that really can get under people's skin.
It drives me crazy when I used to leave Tuscany after a nice peppers and sausage. And I got a ticket there. I didn't know who to go to, you know? It just bothered me. I mean, it just bothered me. The whole idea that you're going to stick people who are coming out of Tuscany or Oak Brook. I'm going to buy a stock pot, for example. And then it ends up costing me $200, you know?
Right.
A pain. But people identify with the red light cameras. Now, where's that going to go, do you think? Where's Nikki Zoller? I remember Nikki Zoller, one of the co-founders with Omar Mahdi of SafeSpeed LLC. She, Omar screws up my cigar store. I can't even go to my cigar store because I'm waiting to see, you know, a bunch of Irish guys in button down collars sitting in a van right outside, you know, from Boston College. And it kind of like chills the atmosphere. So I can't, you know, if I go there, not that I'm against it. I love that those guys are great. They're some of the best investigators in the world.
Right, the FBI, but
yeah, but you don't want to get pinched up like, oh, honey, I'm not going to be home for dinner because we all got on the federal bus. And, you know, I don't want that in my life. And then, I see Nikki Zoller when you guys did a story on the beginning of this with Sandoval a few months ago. Jason Meisner and our colleagues tried to reach Nikki Zoller, and she wouldn't, of SafeSpeed LLC, she wouldn't respond. She didn't even.
Oh, yeah.
But then she ran to the Sun-Times in a story, I guess, that they pitched and said, we don't bribe anybody. Now,
it hadn't come out yet. It was after the raids that happened in the end of September. We had heard that SafeSpeed was among the avenues of interest for the FBI. So I, for days, I was trying to reach her. And then I went to her company twice. The second time she was there because the receptionist said, oh, she's in a meeting. She disappeared for like 5 minutes, comes back, said, yeah, she's not available, so call you. And then it was like 2 or 3 days after that she claimed in the Sun-Times story, and I give kudos to them for getting her to talk, but he claimed that no one has reached out to me. Apparently she didn't get my messages and didn't know I was there, but I know she did. But she has said all along now, after it did come out that SafeSpeed was target, that they had no idea what Omar Mahdi was doing. They don't sanction bribes. They've never paid a bribe or authorized it. That apparently he was freelancing for them. And giving all this money, spreading it around. So,
you know, that's like to me, I respect that because I understand that's their statement. And I can't wait for Exelon to say, Bill Von Haney, big boss in charge of lobbying at Exelon didn't know anything about Anne Pramaggiore, and he didn't know anything about lobbying in Springfield. I don't know. You just want to roll over and have a cigarette and stare at the sun, stare at the moon. So, Jason, Jeff has another question. Ask it, Jeff.
Jason, I haven't seen, I've got a friend who's working in Springfield and was telling me the story about somebody on the Illinois Gaming Board leaking information to various federal agencies and now has been removed from their position or suspended from their position. Have you heard anything about that or any repercussions from that?
No, I did see that. I haven't had a chance with everything going on this week to really kind of dig into what was going on there. The whole gaming thing is all tied up now. We got, push for sports gambling and casinos, racetrack, what they call the racino or casino racetrack. And behind it all, you've got these figures like Rick Heidner, who was named in a federal search warrant. And is part of the whole Sandoval investigation. And his company's David Heinzman for the Tribune reported that he's in business with some guys who have mob ties and has told dream to build this Racino in Tinley Park went down in flames after that story came out.
I'm feeling sorry for all the honest outfit bookies squeezing those bookmakers, you know, the outfit crews. How can you make any money when the state's involved, you know, when they cut you in? It's got to be aggravating. It is. So, you know what I think we do next time? We go to 59th and Kedzie. There's a restaurant I heard there where you can get a Marty Sandoval shingle asphalt sandwich. Just say Mike Vondra sent me.
Sandwich.
Yeah.
Sandwich. Thanks, Jason Meisner. See you soon, right, man. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
Thanks, right, Jason.
Yeah.
For Michael Peck, director of the great Clarence Thomas movie that you should see, and for Jason Meisner, my colleague at the Chicago Tribune, the federal reporter doing all this great stuff with all our colleagues, trying to keep you informed on the big federal bus rolling from Chicago to Springfield, and it's not done rolling. And for Jeff Carlin, executive producer of the Rokon Show on WGN. And for me, a man whose father plowed with a mule too. And I use it as a joke, sometimes to mock. But watching that movie, I began to think of him, and I thought of Clarence Thomas's grandfather. And I broke down, thinking of my dad, thinking of men like that, uncompromising men. There was a right way to do things and a wrong way. You stand up with your back straight, and you don't give up until you die. And I miss my dad. I'm John Cass, husband, father, columnist for the Chicago Tribune and member of its editorial board. Come back again and visit with us. We love you guys on the Chicago Way on WGN+.